Welcome back to the History of South Africa podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. This is episode 231. Mashweshwe, the Basutu king who had outwitted, outfought, and outlived most of his enemies, was now nearing his end. He had managed to ensure his chiefdom survived in signing the Treaty of Aliwal North with the British, who then annexed his territory. Or at least they were about to, but there were some loose ends to tie up before the colonial office signed off on the deal. One of the loose ends was the opposition from some French missionaries who took exception to the treaty, believing it was a cozy deal agreed between the British and the Boers of the Orange Free State, which left Mashweshwe's people with far less territory than they had originally claimed. The most pressing matter was food. Could the Basutu feed themselves with less arable land following the ceding of much of the Caledon Valley to the Boers? David Dale Buchanan, who was the editor of the Witness newspaper based in Pietermaritzburg, had championed Mashweshwe's claim for expanded sovereignty during the boundary talks. Paris Evangelical Missionary Society's François Daumont joined Buchanan in actively lobbying the British government in London to reverse or soften the settlement terms that had been unfavourable to Mashweshwe. Buchanan used his platform in Natal's colonial press to rally public and political support for Mashweshwe, portraying the Basutu as deserving more than just boundaries, and influenced the colonial secretary to consider Mashweshwe's case more sympathetically. Meanwhile, Daumont took the issue straight to the corridors of British power in London, sailing to Britain in 1869. He pressed the Foreign Office and Colonial Office to reconsider the treaty's terms. Their joint efforts helped shape the High Commissioner's Notice of May 13, 1870, with an amendment in November 1871. This modification adjusted the Aliwal North boundary by extending Basutu land east along the Caledon River to its true headwaters and restoring territory around Chief Morapo that the Orange Free State had claimed. These revisions returned critical grazing land and strategic highlands to Basutoland. Unfortunately, as you're going to hear, Mashweshwe wasn't around to experience the fruits of their diplomacy. The king could barely walk by the end of 1869. In February of that year, he'd been too weak to attend Governor Philip Boithouse's Pitsu gathering at Korokoro, only a short distance down the hill from Thabo Basu, his mountain stronghold. He had built up his kingdom, battling against all odds. First, the raiders of the Mfikani, then the Amandebele and Amazulu, the Kurana, the Griqua, all musket riders from the south, then the Boers, then the British. Mashweshwe had built support among junior chiefs by placing them in charge of cattle posts and creating marriage alliances through bride wealth paid in cattle. His nation building drew on two closely linked institutions. One was a system of obligations embodied in cattle, and the other was an ancestral mandate that placed Mashweshwe at the head of the lineage, binding his network of cattle-based relations under the name Basutu. In this world, cattle became ancestors, which is led directly to the Sesotho proverb, Mulimu o Nko o Metsi, which is best read as ancestor with a wet nose, the cow. This went further. Cattle were such an integral part of Mashweshwe's statecraft, he seems to suggest, that raiding for cattle was an almost foregone conclusion. He literally made a name for himself as a skilled raider, replacing his birth name, Lekgopo, with an onomatopoeic moniker, Shweshwe, which means cattle raiser. He changed his name to Mashweshwe. Praise poets incorporated the history of raiding and his name and developed his reputation still further. The penchant for raiding is what caused him trouble with the Boers, who accused him and his chiefs of constant rustling activities on the borderland. By early 1870, Mashweshwe had entered what his young son Tlali called his second childhood. Thanks to his amazingly robust constitution, somehow he hung on to life for several months when most would have passed away far earlier. But all visitors could see how the once powerful warrior was wasting away. Another chief, Letswana, was now settling down in his old home area of Putiatsana Valley, foregoing the years of constant raiding that got him into trouble with the Boers. Molotsani of the Taung migrated to Mokgali's Hook all the way from the right bank, the Free State right side of the Caledon River, to western Basutoland. Molotsani was bitter about losing that arable land and arriving in a place that was more mountainous with fewer rivers. Morosi, the Puti chief in the Kuting district, would wait two more years before he formally announced in 1872 that he would also join Basutoland after squabbling with Sotho chiefs for some time. Population estimates indicate that the number of people living in Basutoland had decreased. When the next rough census was taken in 1875, the population was estimated at 175,000. In the 1860s, several thousand had died of starvation in the preceding years through warfare and drought, or had been killed by Free State commandos. Thousands remained outside Basutoland, working on farms or the towns in the Free State, Cape, Natal. Moshoeshoe's son Sikonyela moved south, settling near the Griquas of Adam Cook. This territory would eventually be annexed by the Cape Colony in 1879. Moshoeshoe's half-brother Mopere stayed behind at Witsie's Hook and became a subject of the Free State Boers. Many others began to migrate to the diamond fields around Kimberley. So it was on a January morning of 1870 that Moshoeshoe roused himself like a candle flickering before it went out. He was about to perform a remarkable act, almost unheard of in Southern African tradition. In his last official duty, Moshoeshoe convened a meeting of chiefs and headmen at Tabo Basu and announced he was abdicating in favour of his eldest son, Letsie. This was almost a hospital pass, because Letsie would now take over a land compressed on all sides by pressure groups, African and colonial. It was still unclear if Basutoland would survive, having barely scraped through the previous few years. The Free State Basutu War of 1865 to 1868 had drained the country of food and crushed much of its spirit. But it was not defeated and emerged under Letsie, balanced on a knife edge, now protected by the British Empire. Moshoeshoe followed up his announcement at the meeting with more orders that when Letsie died, he should be succeeded by Motswane, who was the only child of Letsie's first wife, Senati, and Senati's father was Josefa, who was the eldest son of Morapo's first wife. I'll explain now all the intricacies. This was an attempt by Moshoeshoe to create cohesion, but it was doomed to fail because he was unilaterally changing Basutu laws of succession. The reason is that primogeniture through the senior wife was sacred. Inheritance typically followed the firstborn male of the principal marriage. Moshoeshoe's maneuvers, turning Senati into a male role and engineering marriages, pushed those norms to their limit, innovating legal fictions which were rarely tolerated. Ultimately, the Basutu Council rejected the plan, but after his death. They instead installed Leratoli despite his secondary line birth. As traditional male line, succession was simpler and less contentious. Letsie would die in 1891. His first son, Leratoli, did have a claim but was born of a secondary wife, not the senior wife, thus complicating the customary order. To uphold the primogeniture principle through the senior wife's line, Moshoeshoe had crafted a radical workaround, which identified Senati, Letsie's half-sister, by the principal wife, and had her ritually converted into a kind of female husband. He had ordered that she be given a horse, and after mounting the steed, was given symbolic regalia and declared heir, mirroring rare customary legal fictions permitted when male heirs were absent. But they weren't absent. Moshoeshoe ordered Senati to be married to Joseph Morapo so they'd have a son, Motswane, who was presumed to represent the senior line. Then he simultaneously arranged for Leratoli to marry Manila to bring him into the senior wife's line, another layer of legal fiction. These plans were deeply controversial as they attempted to reshape gender and lineage norms. Senati's conversion to male was especially unprecedented. And so it would eventually fail and lead to more instability in the Mountain Kingdom in the future. But let us return to the final weeks of Moshoeshoe's life, marked by an unseemly rivalry between French, Protestants and Catholics. It is striking how the distant quarrels of European theology left their mark on South African history. Even today, many of the French surnames scattered across the country carry the legacy of that bitter struggle between Christians. The Huguenots were French Protestants who had had such a significant bearing on South Africa's history, arriving in the Cape mainly in 1688 and 89. They were part of the VOC policy to bolster the colony's agricultural output by allocating land to European farmers. The Huguenots mostly settled in the Drakenstein Valley and the surrounding areas of the Western Cape, and the towns grew around them, places like Paarl, Franschhoek, Wagenmakersvallei, which became Wellington. As you know from a very early episode of this series, the Huguenots, being French Protestants, followed the teachings of John Calvin, while Catholics adhered to the doctrines and traditions of the Roman Catholic Church. The Protestants endured significant religious persecution in France, especially during the French Wars of Religion and under the rule of Louis XIV, leading to mass emigration, with many seeking refuge in countries like England, the Netherlands, Germany, and South Africa. They brought their esteemed skills and trades, including banking, commerce, the arts, agriculture, all the way to Africa, and their contributions helped shape the societies they joined. Now the missionaries, these pious agents of two rival creeds, circled Mushweshwe like carrion birds, each convinced they could claim a slice of his soul. Strap in! This isn't your usual Sunday school tale. What follows is a twisted 19th century fever dream where faith collides with power and reality bends into something far stranger than fiction. The old Basutu fox, Mushweshwe, had toyed with Christianity for years. Sometimes he wore it like a borrowed coat, sometimes he tossed it aside. The French missionaries were his pawns in a diplomatic game. Sometimes they attempted to make him in their own image, their crosses as useful as any spear or treaty. The theocratic ideals, mere garnish. But now, as his life flickered out, some of his adherents began to migrate to other chiefs like Letsi, sensing that the enfeebled monarch would have no hold after his passing. The religious factions also hitched themselves to these wagons. It was a lottery of sorts, a gamble. Invest holy sweat in the wrong chief, and it could backfire for these French missionaries. Combine this divine pressure with the fact that traditional prophets were also still active around Thabo Mbeki, and you can sense a dramatic ending to this important man's death. By 1870, Mansopa the prophet had joined Taung chief Moritsani at the stronghold and had both converted to Christianity. There were over 3,000 converts living amongst the Basutu now. The big problem was hardly any of the senior chiefs had bought into the message. The main French characters in this Shakespearean or perhaps Miltonesque drama were Eugène Cassali and Thomas Aubusset, as you've heard previously, of the Paris Evangelical Missionary Society, or PEMS. The Protestant team, together with assistant Constant Gosselin, they had engaged with the Basutu before the formation of the kingdom, all the way back in the 1830s. First come, first served, as they say. But the fresh new Protestant reverend, Théophile Jusset, who would play a significant role in the last part of Mushweshwe's life, had his own issues. He was every inch the Victorian prig. He claimed Mushweshwe's physical decline stemmed from his sexual relations with the young wives he had married in recent years. The real reason was far simpler: age. Mushweshwe was in his 80s, and modern health enthusiasts would probably argue that those same young wives had possibly helped him live so long. Research on longevity often points to strong social bonds, reduced loneliness, and yes, even regular intimacy as beneficial in later life. Enter the French Catholics, 1862. Bishop Allard and Father Joseph Gérard of the Oblates of Mary Immaculate received permission from Mushweshwe to found a mission at Tlaotle, later renamed Roma. It was in a valley about 14 kilometers southeast of Thabo Mbeki. They immediately set about doing what religious zealots do when they have competition from other religious zealots. They began a propaganda campaign against the Protestants. Mushweshwe was entertained by these two different sets of Christians. He spent a great deal of time trying to convert him to their brand of Christianity, warning that the other brand was tantamount to a vote for the devil. Of course, both sets of missionaries also threw philosophical stones at the traditional prophets who were throwing the bones. The Catholics pointed out that Protestants couldn't be the true religion of Christ because Protestantism was founded 1,500 years after Christ's death. Furthermore, they said that the Catholic Church was more like Mushweshwe's own kingdom. It had a similar hierarchical structure. The Catholics cunningly adopted a less rigid attitude to Sesotho customs, permitting bukhali, or the transfer of marriage cattle, lobola. The Protestants across the Cape and into Basutu land had always railed against this practice, saying it compelled a woman to marry a man against her will. Then the Catholics pulled out their vestments, their incense, the images of Mary and Christ, their music, a veritable sea of pageantry, which was designed to appeal to Mashweshwe's sensuous side. The Protestants were underdressing their theocracy, said the Catholics. They were in philosophical loincloths, Calvin without the Klein, whereas the Catholics, well, just take a look at their magnificent robes, their glinting papal crowns, their odd Latin litanies. Then the Catholics seemed to tip the scales when they introduced their secret weapon, nuns. A group of nuns arrived in Roma in May 1865, and after the Free State Boers had ransacked and destroyed the Protestant mission station below Tabo Bisu during that vicious war, it was the nuns who took in Mushweshwe's wives and children. It was the nuns who prepared food for Father Gerard to carry up the mountain to Mushweshwe, and it was subsequently the nuns who helped the Catholics make their first conversions in 1865. At the end of the war against the Free State, Mushweshwe attended the first ever baptism of an aged village headman on Tabo Bisu. By the end of his life, Mushweshwe had grown fascinated by the doctrinal debates between these two Christian sects, but was angling towards the Catholics because of their conservative social values. The Catholic converts, he said, appeared to be more loyal to the Basutu cause, and also they'd been teaching his people better skills. In an odd way, Mushweshwe turned into a kind of religious referee. Earlier, he told a congregation gathered at Tlaoutle/Roma that, "Though I am still only a pagan, I am a Christian in my heart. There is still some darkness when it is a question of discerning among the Christian religions which is the true one. However, I do not doubt that when you come to listen to these missionaries and take the trouble to examine the question, you will manage to discover which is the true religion of Jesus Christ." Luckily, Mushweshwe was patient, because the rivalry between the Christian missions became extremely acrimonious. The Protestants were furious that these Catholics were latecomers to their pious party. Meanwhile, the Catholics told the Basutu they were actually saving them from apostasy and heresy. "The Holy Virgin will break the head of all these heresies," fumed Gerard in his journal dated January 1867. Later, in November of that year, Gerard described how he'd met Jussé of the Paris Evangelical Mission, the Protestant who'd given him a glacial handshake as cold as in Siberia. Jussé had confronted Gerard, accusing him of coming to work in my field. Bad vibes all around. And around Tabo Bisu and Tlaoutle, the Basutu began to slip easily into the rhythms of rivalry, styling themselves as Bafora, the French, the Protestants, or Baroma, the people of Rome, the Catholics. Adherents of both began interfering in the services of the other, interrupting sermons, debating ideology. When Mushweshwe weakened in 1870, both groups of missionaries intensified their attempts at converting the old warrior king, sensing whomever won his soul would likely win his people. And it is now that I must tell you that there are two versions of what happened next. Not oral history versions. Oh no, dear listener. Written in ink on paper. So for anyone listening who happens to regard the written word as sacrosanct and oral history as not, this will come as a bit of a shock. The Protestant version was written down by Jussé and Adèle Mabil, wife of a missionary at Moria. She was the daughter of Eugène Casalien and had been born in Basutoland in 1840 in the mission house below Tabo Bisu. Mushweshwe was like her godfather. Missionary Mabil had tried to convert Mushweshwe in his final months in January 1870. Mushweshwe covered his face, hiding from Adèle, claiming he was afraid of the young woman. She prayed back, asking God to have mercy on him, and Mushweshwe snapped, "A sinner? I too shall go to heaven." Counselors told the priests that Mushweshwe had the Holy Spirit. It's just that he was afraid of showing it to his people. In these final days, Jussé had one more go and appeared to succeed. It all revolved around the 14th chapter of the Gospel of St. John. Jussé embellished the chapter, and his incantations included the line that, "Son of Mokashani," to envelop Mushweshwe in the cloak of his verse, "a throne is prepared for you in heaven. Believe in Jesus, the Savior of the world, and you will be saved." Jussé then walked back down the hill to his home, and Mushweshwe thought about things and sent a message to Casalien and Abusé saying he had become a believer. This, remember, is Adele Mabille's version of events. She just had a son, and Mushweshwe apparently told her that he had been born just like her son. Like her son, he said. He was beginning to be a man. She would repeat this tale in many letters. On the other side of the pew, the Catholic's version is contained in Father Gerard's journal. On 26th January 1870, he wrote that Mushweshwe was impressed by the grand vision of the Catholic Church, all the pomp and the ceremony and the conservatism. But Gerard hinted at conspiracy. His people couldn't get inside the hut in which Mushweshwe lay because of the councillors. They were denying entry. And when Mushweshwe was well enough to talk, they'd only allow the Catholics in if the Protestant Jussé was present. The Catholics plotted their strategy. They kept the hut under surveillance and noticed that when the weather was bad, the guards were lax. The guards were also lax during the night. Unfortunately, the Protestants, wrote Gerard, got wind of the Catholic plan to launch their spirited conversion, perhaps at night in bad weather, and redoubled their efforts to surround him. This is all true, dear listener, no exaggeration. This competition took place. One night in February 1870, Gerard managed to secure a one-on-one with Mushweshwe and his councillors, sans Jussé. But the king said, "I have two eyes. That is to say, one looks at Rarotifora, the other the Baroma." In other words, one looks at the Protestants and the other the Catholics. Gerard became more obsessed with converting the king. On the 11th of March, he recorded, "For the last 15 days, I have redoubled the visits to Mushweshwe. On his side, a great weakness to declare himself for a true religion," he groaned. "But who does not see that he is not converted, wishing to satisfy both the Catholics and the Protestants? However, if he has a preference, it seems that it would be for us." The Protestants were recording similar thoughts, but vice versa. During that month of February, Mushweshwe had called his sons to his side to explain how his property would be disposed after his death and also told them one by one that he was going to be baptized. Morapo was dismayed and held a customary dance with the customary drinking and dancing directly after he left his father's side just to let everyone know he wasn't interested in this Christian baptism thing. Other sons, those born after 1833, were aghast at the implication that they'd been denied an inheritance. Somehow, the desperately ill king managed to clamber to his feet in February and ordered his cattle to be gathered together for a last inspection. He told Letsy he'd inherit all the cattle, except for those assigned to the houses of his junior wives and the Bokhali cattle each house had received for the marriage of its own daughters. This was a public display ensuring the Basutu were aware that the king was adhering to the traditional ways, reinforcing the past. The French Protestants published a notice in their March newsletter saying Mushweshwe was going to be baptized at Thabo Bosu on the 20th of March during their annual conference. But Mushweshwe sank into a coma early in March, so the annual conference was brought forward to the 13th. On the morning of the 11th of March, 1870, hordes of Protestants from mission stations across Basutoland were wending their way to Thabo Bosu. Joining in a kind of reconnaissance mission was Catholic Father Gerard, keeping an eye on the Protestants. They were all too late. One of Southern Africa's most influential men, Mushweshwe, had drawn his last breath at 9 a.m. on the 11th of March, 1870. As historian Leonard Thompson notes, he died as he lived, in two worlds. He was buried the next day on his mountain alongside his father, Mokochani, and his first wife, Ma Mohato. It was the Protestant priest, Jussé, and not the Catholics, who conducted his funeral service in the presence of Letsi, Morapo, Mosopa, and an estimated 4,000 Basutu. A week later, Governor Sir Philip Wodehouse and a representative of the Orange Free State exchange the final ratifications of the Treaty of Aliwal North. It's still debated whether Mushweshwe was baptized or not. Oral tradition speaks of an earthquake that was registered in Basutoland shortly afterwards. a virtual earthquake had taken place in terms of historical significance. At the territory of Laribe, Morapa's poets composed a new song which spread through Basutu land. Re ba mang Basutu, ha moshweshu ashwele, retla sala re le bamang, bata se shwele le mabala, tesele oa mokachani, basoto re bamang. Who are we, Basutu, when Moshweshwe is dead? Whose people shall we be? The leopard had died with its colors, Tesele, son of Mokachani. Basutu, whose people are we now? This question lingers into the 21st century. Lesotho's economy is facing new strains, this time through a 50% tariff on its exports to the United States. Although the measures appear postponed, most textile orders have been cancelled. In July 2025, the Lesotho government declared a state of disaster. Around 10,000 workers in factories supplying Levi Strauss and other brands have been affected, with estimates suggesting as many as 40,000 livelihoods could be at risk. It's a different kind of pressure now, less visible, more drawn out. Not the charge of horsemen, but shifting trade winds and silent factories. So perhaps we should ask, Basutu Rebamang? Please rate the podcast on your favorite platforms. It helps elevate its visibility. You can head off to desmondlatham.blog. I'm going to load an update about various episodes. You can email me from there too. Ret la sala, rele bamang.